Okay, I'll slowly start now.
Larger writing, please. It's not just my old eyes. I think the people who are watching this on the podcast may have some trouble.
No one's going to like it. So this talk is about membrane-mediated interactions between membrane proteins. I was asked to give this talk by Marcus and Paul. So if, well, you won't hear anything about,
of course. Paul? You'll be here.
He'll be here. So when you realize this is not a multi-scale talk with, you know, no mention of representativity, transferability, or coarse grain beads, you know whom to blame, not me. Right, so let me draw a picture of the physical situation. We have this soft surface, and there are so-called inclusions on it. Before talking in any detail of the problem, let me just parameterize the surface. So we're using using the so-called Monge gauge. Where the surface is parameterized as a height above the real plane. And well, this is the base plane. And I'm assuming these inclusions have a circular projection on the base plane. Right, so what's the physics here? What interacts and why do they interact? So you can imagine, well, the example I'm going to do today is this is a membrane, a bending-based Hamiltonian, where these regions are completely rigid. So when the surface fluctuates, it's going to sample its base space like this. Well, continuous first derivative. Where, so this is like a cross-section view of a situation. Or if the particles are already curved, you might get something like this. So the idea is, this is a bending surface. So, well, first of all, the inclusions are in the surface, so we want the height function to join with the inclusion at the contact. Also, since this is a bending surface, discontinuities in the first derivative will be penalized by an infinite energy density. So, there will be a boundary condition that the contact angle, the normal gradient of the field is also continuous across inside and outside. So these are the constraints on the surface imposed by the inclusions, and this is how the surface knows that they are there.
So does this exclude the what I think of as the simplest case, that is, where there's a hydrophobic mismatch? And
yes, it excludes that.
So this is different effects, the one you described.
Yeah.
Could you do this for a thickness field or something of that nature to include that kind of?
I would assume I should be able to do that. So this is a fluctuating field, but in the ground state, at zero temperature, you can imagine something of this sort happens. So the surface is deformed by the objects on it. And you can imagine this is sort of like two electric charges or two charged conductors in an electrostatic problem interacting, and there's not much question whether there would be an interaction energy in this, in such a case or not. It's the kind of problem we're used to. There are permanent deformations on a field. There are boundary conditions that the solution has to obey, and the solution and the energy of the solution depend on the positions of the particles. So there's a force, and that I will call a membrane-mediated interaction. If the particles are flat, there's no reason for the surface to curve. So the ground state is completely flat, and classically, there's no interaction. But still, there's an analog of the Casimir effect. So this surface fluctuates thermally. It doesn't just stay at its ground state. And the constraints, well, even if it fluctuates, it will never be able to explore a shape where the objects that I assumed are non-bendable are bent. So this is excluded. So the Boltzmann factors of the problem are modified by the presence of these constraints. And after you calculate the partition function under these constraints, the free energy will end up depending on the positions of the particles. And even if there is no interaction of this form at the ground state level, there will be a fluctuation-induced interaction, like the Casimir effect. So the interaction potential, it's generally a free energy. It will be proportional to kt times some function of the positions of the particles here, and in the elastic case it will be proportional to the elastic property of the surface, because it doesn't have anything to do with temperature. It happens at zero temperature, and some other function of the coordinates. Right. And the purpose of this talk is to show you one way to calculate the configuration-dependent free energy in a kind of an efficient formalism. So the framework we use is called effective field theory. So we write a Hamiltonian functional of the height field. This is the Hamiltonian is the usual Hartree Hamiltonian. And to be able to do any analytic calculations, it is the small gradient approximation version of it. So before doing any effective field theory, you can imagine, so this Hamiltonian, this kappa, rather, is valid only in the regions of the base plane where there is no inclusion. So
this integral is not over R squared.
It's over some subset of R squared, these circles excluded. So the first thing that comes to mind is whenever you do partition functions or any or try to solve the boundary value problem for such a case, you're going to want to implement the boundary conditions that the field is subject to along the boundaries of this S at every step. So we have this field theorist in our department at CMU. And as we were struggling with the problem, he said, look, guys, real men don't do it like this. They do it like this. So in particle physics, for example, you have this field, and you have heavy bosons doing weird stuff, creating particles and what have you. Sometimes you don't even know what they do. Sometimes you do, but you don't want to bother with them when you do calculations. So what you do is you add, you take the simple free field Lagrangian and add pieces to it that incorporate the short distance physics that you don't want to bother with, or maybe you don't know. So Ira said we could use the same method here by not bothering with these finite sized boundaries all the time, but putting, well, since these things are localized, the short distance physics is not valid everywhere in the block. They're only valid in localized regions. So it turns out you can augment a free field theory with some localized terms to capture the presence of these things. Right. So what are these terms going to look like? For example, you can have something like this. R1 is the position of a particle, the labeling with 1. And these are derivatives. This has to be a scalar because the Hamiltonian is a scalar. So this kind of term would capture the presence of a curved particle. And you can see, for example...
Do we need to square that or something?
Not yet. Well, that... I'll come to quadratic terms in a second.
Okay.
So what's the index on the R?
I'm sorry, index on what?
On the R. Yeah, that's the index. Well,
that's guy 1, guy 2, guy 3.
I mean, I could, you know, this is something that we do. You could add and subtract, right, the contributions of the Hamiltonian, treating that piece of the bilayer as a different material.
Yeah. But that.
And then this would, I guess, be an expansion of such a material model.
Yeah. But you can equivalently treat the system like that as well. This we find easy. Right. So this linear term is a so-called source term. And the meaning is, if you minimize this Hamiltonian, let's forget about other particles for now. If you minimize this energy in the presence of this term, so you vary the Hamiltonian, set it equal to 0, what you get is kappa times, well, this is small, isn't it? Is equal to minus qij derivative of a delta function concentrated at this point. So it's, well, localized charge. Poisson equation for a localized charge. So this is an example of a permanent source.
So how do you get the second line? I mean, this is how you're going to...
Oh.
You're going to get the second line for... See, like a Lagrange equation with that thing.
If you plug in H plus delta H and set the variation to 0, that's okay. And of course, if you have a source like this, then you can find the field of this source by a convolution. And, well, this is easy. It's a delta function, so it's going to give you So this type of term encodes the presence of permanent deformations like this. But more importantly, even if there are these permanent deformations or they don't exist, there's still these boundary conditions that the compact regions must obey. And those will be induced source terms, because you can, for example, going back to the electrostatics analogy, a charge-neutral sphere, conducting sphere, may not deform the electric field, but if you were to, say, put a charge nearby, therefore embedding the conducting sphere in a field configuration that it's not comfortable with, charges will move around, it will generate its own field to make sure it's still an equipotential surface. So that we would call an induced charge or induced polarization. And that kind of term will look something of this sort. Don't mind the labeling right now. So these will be quadratic in the field, because the whole reason I did the linear case so well, step by step, was to be able to justify the induced charge bit quickly. So the meaning of an induced charge is
source.
Is that, well, it's not there unless you impose an external or background field. So you let H go to H background plus H response, and then you get, well, when you expand the quadratic term, you get a linear term, and that linear term acts just like this. But the magnitude of the source is proportional to somehow the second derivative, in this example that I gave you, of the background at the position of the inclusion. So that's an induced source, and it will generate its own field, taking a convolution with the Green function. And of course, you can imagine other terms, like, why not something like this? And terms with more derivatives, terms, of course, involving the other particles. Sure, I mean, we want to calculate the interaction between them.
If I get something really naive, I mean, would this get me appropriate values for QI, QJ? I mean, if I just added, subtract over a circular patch, you know, a Hamiltonian term with a spontaneous curvature, and then I expand that out as the patch size goes to zero, mm-hmm. would that be a way of getting an expansion that would match up with these coefficients QI?
No, if you naively take the size of your inclusions to zero, well, that's physically considering very small particles. But this does not assume very small particles. So if your particle is tiny, for example, it means it doesn't occupy too much space.
Yes.
to sense the effect of a very wiggly background.
I would think it would be opposite. It was very small.
That's true.
It would be insensitive to look.
That's true.
Spatial mass.
But you do want to make a point particle theory for particles that are manifestly not point particles. Their finite size ends up in these prefactors in a way
right.
that we haven't yet discussed.
Okay, I see. I mean, I'm just trying to think if there's another way to get that. But you're going to tell us how you get the QIJ
shortly.
In terms of the induced curvature, in terms of properties that you might attribute to the
propagators. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'll do it very briefly. So, what are these things? So this brings up each issue of matching. So if you write all possible terms consistent with the symmetries of the problem, like, for example, these boundaries are circular, so no tensor coefficients are involved. But still, you don't know what these coefficients are. And supposedly, this effective theory is a mock theory that is equivalent to the full theory with the full-sized particles. So you need to make sure the terms that you added to the free theory do capture these things. And by the way, I'm going to refer to these as polarizabilities. So how do you fix them? Well, as I showed you here, you can calculate the response of a permanent or induced charge using, you know, doing some index contraction. At the end, you're going to get some derivative of the Green function multiplied by the coefficient that you're looking for. And the Green function is, for this Hamiltonian, so for example, two derivatives on the Green function will give you a power law sort of going r to the zero with a logarithm. Four derivatives on the Green function will give you a response that go like 1/r squared. So it's pretty easy to get the responses from the effective theory, the point particle theory, if you want. So the easiest observable to match, to make sure the physical observables in the full theory and the effective field theory agree, is, well, the response. And you do this by, well, the response is a biharmonic function that lives outside the inclusion. And is subject to such boundary conditions as it plus the background that you apply at the boundary must be, well, okay. There's something I forgot to talk about. So these disks floating on the fluid surface, well, are floating. So they can fluctuate like this as well as tilt. So the boundary curve, the contact curve, is going to be confined within a plane. And this is the equation of a plane. You know? And also, this is a fourth order differential equation. We require square integrability of the of the square Laplacian over the whole surface, and that fixes 2 degrees of freedom at large distances, and you're left with, you have to specify the two things at the local boundaries. The one is the value, the other one is the normal derivative along the surface. And this will be, and potentially, if we're doing a situation where there's a contact line imposed by the presence of the objects, there's something wrong here, isn't there? Oh, yeah. What I meant here was B dot R hat. And potentially, as I said, if there is the contact angle imposed by a curved inclusion, you get another constant. I'm not going to solve this for you. It's going to take long, but you can believe that there are solutions to this in books in polar coordinates with four coefficients at each multiple to fix. And, well, two of them will go away due to square integrability. The other two are going to be fixed. And as long as you can satisfy boundary conditions at some value of these coefficients A and B, that means there's a physical solution. And those and what A and B translate to is the degree of freedom of the inclusion to move up and down and tilt. So it means you applied a background. Maybe the background requires the object to tilt and adapt to it. Well, the object is able to do that, and that is encoded with the degree of freedom B. And as long as you can find a B that solves the equation, that means that background is allowable, so on and so forth.
So, I'm sorry, just sorry, I want to understand this well. So the H background, what is that again? I mean, how does that define it?
Well, you choose it.
Okay, so that's just, you choose a reference height field.
Let me,
and then this is a perturbation from that reference height field.
Yeah, let me give you an example. So if you need to find this coefficient,
yes.
You need a background that will be non-zero yeah. at this point after you differentiate it twice. Let's say this point is zero, the origin.
Mm-hmm.
So if you apply this background.
But you care about setting the other terms to be zero simultaneously?
If you apply this background, this will trigger a response from this guy.
Yes.
It won't trigger any response from this
I
guy.
See. Yep. See,
because if you differentiate, well, you can't differentiate it this
sure.
three times at the origin. You get zero.
Sure.
So you can, in this problem at least, it's not. It doesn't apply to every effective field theory, you know, nonlinear effective field theories for particle physics. But in our problem, it is possible to choose backgrounds that only in excite one or two of the coefficients.
But I mean, once you know Qij, then can you use that to get then C12 and then C23?
No.
Yeah.
No, because the fact that these objects are rigid and the fact that these objects might be curved are independent facts.
Sure.
You can have a flat rigid inclusion that will have a polarizability.
Yeah, sure.
You can have a curved rigid inclusion that will have a polarizability, but its permanent curvature is a different quantity. There's no connection between them.
But I guess what I'm saying is you could choose a background field so that only the term involving Qij is non-zero, C12, C13, all of those are zero, and then solve for Q12. Is that the point of solving this whole response theory, to pick off coefficient by coefficient what the terms are in the expansion? Or am I misunderstanding?
What?
The full response theory that you have to do.
What
are the equations that you need to, that you would solve to get Qij, C2, C3, C4, etc.?
The Qs. So the permanent charges, not the induced charges?
Well, are these C12, is that a function or is that a multiple
times? It's a number.
Yes. So presumably you want to get an expansion of the Hamiltonian in terms of this effective theory. So how do you solve for the coefficients Qij, C12, and C13? How do you know what those numbers are, is what I'm asking.
Okay, I'm trying to explain that here, but I'm not being clear. So anyways.
Are you going to use this full theory response in order to
determine it?
So the boundary conditions, these A, B terms, if you had a particular prescribed radius and matching division for the angle at which the bilayer hits the protein, you give that as input, and then from this theory, you should be able to get out of it.
Well, with those inputs, there's going to be, with this applied field, you will find a response. In this case, will go some coefficient that this boundary value problem will tell you.
Yes,
so it's a coefficient that you know times cosine 2 phi. Believe me.
By solving the full response.
Solving the full response.
The prank, and that's what you get for your particular choice of background.
Yeah.
Okay.
And with this choice of background, the effective theory We'll give you a background. We'll give you a response that is somewhat like this. Right? That is this stuff applied to the case of induced charges, right? For the linear charges, you don't need a background to induce a response. It is there, it's permanent. For the induced charges,
yes.
you need to make this change of variables to get a linear term.
Oh, I see, okay. So you want to, okay.
Time says C12 code.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. So if you apply this change of variables to this term, you get this linear term. Del I, del j, h background, f r1 times.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
Del
because you're going to square it out in the cross terms. One of them is the response and one of them is the background.
Yeah.
I see.
And this linear in h,
yeah.
Background is something you specified. It doesn't fluctuate.
Yes.
So you can do the same thing you did for this term.
Yes.
And you'll get a response that is proportional to the polarizability here.
I see.
So this will give you something involving the polarizability that you're looking for, times cosine 2 phi.
Mm-hmm.
And you can believe this because, you know, g is like r squared.
Sure.
Two derivatives, it's going to be independent of r. But this contraction gives you a cosine 2 phi.
Mm-hmm.
So you know A from the boundary value problem. You don't know C, but now you do. Because if that effective theory is the effective theory for the problem, then the two responses, the response to the same background should be the same. So this is how you can fix these coefficients. You can fix the induced charges like this. You can fix the permanent charges without actually applying a background. They're there.
Now this means that the C's will depend on the number of proteins that you put into the system. It might not depend on their geometric configuration.
No.
No.
You're allowed to take them. Yeah, you're allowed to take them separately because that's like thanks to local physics.
Yeah.
What happens here? The virtual particles created here only work here.
Okay.
So you can take one particle at a time,
mm-hmm.
Fix the polarizabilities of one particle, and then the other one.
Okay, so the theory that you bring down here is for one particle, and then you would just have additional terms, an additional index on your C's.
Yeah.
But they would all come out the same by symmetry.
That's the dot, 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 yeah. But they, yeah, okay, so at the end, you find polarizabilities that go something like kappa times r to the 2m minus 1. It should be correct by dimensional arguments. If you put this polarizability there, count the powers of 1 over length and length. This works. And of course, if they have different radii, well, you'll have R1 on particle 1, you'll have R2 on particle 2. And of course, there are some numbers here which are found by the matching procedure. This is just the scaling of the polarizabilities in terms of the size and the elastic properties of the membrane.
Okay, so what you've written out here is a Hamiltonian for one protein, and you're saying there's no crosstalk between the proteins?
No.
They will crosstalk, but the point is you're constructing an effective field theory for any point particles, but in order to construct it, you only need to look at one particle in a non-fluctuating situation. And after that, your many-particle theory is fixed. What you do with it afterwards is a whole different issue.
Sure.
Well, the free energy will have couplings, the Hamiltonian.
Trying to figure out where the subtlety is in.
So you're
assuming some kind of superposition principle.
No.
But you have to do that, right? Because the Hamiltonian's then going to have another
No, all we're assuming is that the physics is local.
Is local.
And it is.
That is the correction. Okay, so you're just assuming that the correction that needs to be added is local to where the proteins are.
Yeah.
Co-occupying where you have the binary.
Yeah.
And then you just sort of add this on top of it. And so as long as those patches don't overlap, then you're safe.
They're getting very, very close. You might have to add a whole bunch of terms, but.
Yeah. But if they're radioactive.
Every one of which is local and every one of which is determined as well.
Right, so okay, at the end, you're going to have, let me erase this part. So at the end, you're going to have an effective theory that goes like the Hethrich theory plus a sum over particles, a sum over multiple orders. Don't ask me why it starts from 2. Well, it starts from 2 because of the bobbing and tilting degrees of freedom of the particle. So, polarizability, particle label, some shorthand notation here for, you know, alpha derivative of the field. And some permanent sources. But you know, whenever you have a rigid particle, you have all these polarizabilities, quadrupole, octupole, hexadecapole, all orders. But permanent charge is sort of like a situation-dependent variable. Do you have a curved inclusion or not? If so, how curved is it? So I cannot write a general expression for the permanent charges. They're going to be termed like this.
OK, so what happens in permanent source when kappa is is kappa the spontaneous curvature or the bending?
Kappa is the bending rigidity.
Bending
it's the modulus.
OK. All right.
OK.
So where does the spontaneous curvature come into this?
Of
the protein, whether or not it's curved or flat. I guess it comes in the boundary condition of your full theory of response. Is that right?
In the effective theory, it comes from these permanent terms, because if the protein has a spontaneous curvature, that means permanently, without any fluctuations in its ground state, the surface is going to have some sort of decay. And that's the kind of thing this term captures.
The Q-isomers.
Yeah.
And so that would both capture a sort of cup shape as well as like a solid shape.
Yeah, that tensorial form will capture both of them. And in the full theory, the spontaneous curvature will be this thing that I wrote just in case.
Okay.
Because, you know, it will want a certain detachment angle at its rim.
Okay.
Anyways. So right, after you've written the Hamiltonian as something you can deal with plus a perturbation, you can calculate the free energy of interaction as sum over all configurations, e to the minus theta h free minus theta delta h normalized by the free surface partition function, and that's going to be the easiest way to deal with something like that is to expand the exponential. And after taking the logarithm, it becomes a so-called cumulant expansion. Thermal average minus beta delta H to the Q-th power. C denoting cumulant, not just moment, but cumulant.
You should say, you said free cross perturbation, but this is not what the way to do it is perturbatively. But the first line, and that's exact. I mean, we have done an exact mapping between two theories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the top line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you say perturbative, it sometimes implies truncated.
Yeah.
But this time it's not necessarily truncated, because
okay.
Because these are all the terms you can write down given the symmetries with 10,000 derivatives on the field squared. Mm-hmm. But as long as you can fix, and it turns out we can, all of the unknown polarizabilities, your point particle is exactly the finite side particle. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to deal with this expansion is in terms of diagrams. So I'll show you a few example diagrams. So you'll get things like, for example, from Q equals to 1, you're gonna get only self energies, because one power of the perturbation only involves, you know, field factors coming from the same point. So those are self energies that we discard. Interactions start from the power Q equals to 2. And you get things like, so these the quadratic factors here are going to be represented by a wedge. Each leg of the wedge is one of the field factors. For example, right, so each one of these guys is one of the legs.
So the subscript is the protein?
Yeah, subscript is the protein label, superscript is the multiple order. So between two induced charges, when you only write the polarizability, it's clear what the legs are, and it's the factor of 1/2 is implied. So you'll get from the square of the perturbation, you'll get something like a four-point function, and Wick's theorem tells you, discarding self energies, you're going to get this Wick contraction and this Wick contraction, and they evaluate to the inverse of the kernel here, which is 1 over beta kappa times the Green function of the problem.
Doesn't it require some kind of assumption about Gaussianity?
Yeah.
But you don't have to assume Gaussianity.
No. We do assume Gaussianity. The free theory is Gaussian. That's the whole point.
No, we don't assume that. If we write our theory down, the free and Hamiltonian happens to be quadratic, which makes this problem nice.
Yes.
And if we hadn't done it in this EFT version, we still have a quadratic Hamiltonian, but stupid boundary conditions, so none of this works.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is a way to actually make efficient use of the fact that your underlying theory is quadratic and not be killed by the boundary conditions.
Right.
So anyways, this was an example to show that when I draw links between the legs, it will be these Wick contractions.
Yes. Yeah.
All each of which will be Green functions between these two points, where, of course, I forgot. If the field occurrences have derivatives acting on them, they have nothing to do with the thermal average. So after you do the Wick contractions and written the two-point functions as the Green function, well, they're going to be differentiated by an amount that you know from the order of the polarizability here. So, well, this is one possible term. And you can see that this is an interaction that goes like R1 squared, R2 squared over the distance. So on each leg, there's two derivatives. So here, there's 2 plus 2, 4 derivatives on the Green function. It's a 1 over R squared. This is a 1 over R squared as well. So you get that. And, well, people in the field also know this prefactored to be minus 6. So the famous minus 6 times r to the minus 4 interaction is, in terms of these diagrams, a quadrupole-quadrupole interaction. And you can have, so you can find corrections to this with, if you include higher order polarizabilities, for example, this is going to be 3, 4, 7. This is going to be something like 1 to the 8, R2 to the 6 over R1, 2 to the 14, for example. Three derivatives here, four derivatives here. I was wrong. This is wrong. Seven, the G is already 2 powers of distance, I forgot that. So that's a 5, that's a 5, this is a 10. And 4 minus 1, 3, so this is a 6, this is a 4. And you'll also get interactions sort of this way. You can do the same power counting to find what kind of distance dependence they have.
There's no counting for higher terms.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Four wedges, apparently this is a term with Q equals to 4.
I see.
And also, you can get two, I forgot to say something. It's sort of clear here where this dashed line is where polarizability of particle 1 sits. This dashed line is where polarizability of particle 2 sits. So these dashed lines represent the positions. So from Q equals to 4, you can get a pair interaction like this, or you can get a triplet interaction. Or you can get a quadruplet interaction, for example. So these multibodies are actually pretty difficult to get when you don't use EFT.
Mm-hmm.
There's the scattering school of thought. There's the scattering folk that do such calculations with using scattering matrix formalism. They do get the pair interaction to quite high order because that method is also exact like this. But the efficiency of the calculation is not quite at the same level. So the multibody interactions come out really easily from this formalism. So that was one of the advantages. And you can do the power counting as well. You know, you'll get some power of the distance between, let's say these are 1, 2, and 3. You'll get some power of R1, 2, some power of R2, 3, the same thing. So you can predict the form of the interactions pretty easily.
There's a reason why you didn't do 3, Q equals 3. Is that what happens in that moment?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay, no, just...
Dot, dot, dot.
Okay.
You could do that.
It's not like some of the moments are 0. Okay.
No. Not in the bending Hamiltonian, but the tension Hamiltonian, odd cumulants are actually 0.
Okay.
And you don't get a pair term from a Q equals 3. You get a triplet, but you don't get a pair.
It's not even possible, no matter what your Hamiltonian is. If you put an odd number of wedges on two world lines, it is not possible to connect them without
that's
self-energy.
You don't get a pair term because you invariably lost self-energy.
Yeah. But you do get a triplet term with three world lines like...
Mm-hmm.
Like this. Right, so all these diagrams are fluctuation-induced forces. How do I show that? So every wedge brings a power of beta, but then each time you replace a two-point function with a green function, it comes with a 1 over beta in front of it. There's as many links as there are wedges. So all the betas cancel on the right-hand side. You're left with this one. So a free energy, you get a free energy that is proportional to kT. Do you follow?
Yeah, I'm just trying to see why these functions have a one over kT.
Well, if you calculate the two-point function, you get this piece, 1 over times the green function of whatever differential operator is here. So they cancel. But this is not the whole interaction if you have one-legged vertices as well. These would be the permanent charge terms. And the diagrams you can get are, well, the obvious one. This would be the Coulomb interaction, if you like. You can get such diagrams as well. So this would be sort of a source inducing an image on the other guy and then interacting with its image. Along the same lines, you can get a triplet interaction. Triplet interaction where this guy induces an image, and the image interacts with another charge. So these were Kim Noy and Oster wrote in their paper. And they called it an n-body interaction. Mm-hmm. It's just, however, three-body. Because it only involves one induction. But you can imagine having a pair interaction that goes like this, or I don't know, a triplet interaction that goes like.
So if you take these additional terms into account, are the patterns that they reported in the paper stable, or like they had different?
I didn't check. I'm pretty sure that's correct, but.
Because these come in as like a much higher order in R. The additional terms to the right.
Well, not much higher. I mean, these terms are, these are quadrupole charges.
Yes.
This is a quadrupole induced charge. So the power counting ends up that this interaction goes like that. I mean, Pincus, Gulyan, and Boonsma also predicted this in like 93. That was the first time, but the prefactor was wrong. And this is like, and the next one would be, for example, the same diagram where there's an octupole order polarizability here, and that would be, but that's not much worse.
No, okay.
So, I mean, yeah, if you have, like in their paper, if you have an equilateral hexagonal configuration of proteins, stable, given these interactions, mm-hmm. that directly means, if there is also this interaction present, that's not stable then.
In fact, they don't show still, they just show marginal. If you do any kind of homogeneous sensation, the energy doesn't change. So by definition, any next order term, no matter how small,
So right. Knowing that this expansion doesn't stop, it's just a desperate cause to try to find a stable, no force configuration between the particles, as far as I can tell.
Those might want to say a word about the Coulomb interaction first.
So one thing about this interaction is, if you have isotropically curved inclusions, mm-hmm. so this tensor is just a trace, just identity, no off-diagonal parts. That means this interaction is proportional to that, right? Because you're going to get one Laplacian from this guy, one Laplacian from this guy. you would get something anisotropic if the derivatives on the world line term were anisotropic. But in that case, you can see that if the inclusions are isotropic, the derivatives that they take of the green function happen to be the combination of derivatives that kill the green function by definition. So roughly speaking, you can expect, okay, the curved cups are like isotropic quadrupole deformations, mm-hmm. and the green function being R squared, you can expect a quadrupole permanent interaction, Coulombic interaction, mm-hmm. that go like four derivatives on the green function, so 1 over R squared, mm-hmm. but that doesn't exist if you have isotropically curved inclusion. That exists, however, if you have anisotropically curved inclusions. So you can see from here that if Qij and Qkl are just identity, there's a Bi-Laplacian operator hitting the Bi-Laplacian green function. You don't get anything. If they do have off-diagonal terms,
yeah.
you can get a 1 over R squared involving the directionalities of these tensors now, of course, since they're not identity. So these are things that you can read off from the diagrams pretty easily, you know. Is the coefficient isotropic and anisotropic? How many derivatives are there on the green function? How many links versus vertices do you have? And they tell you how the interactions scale in terms of the distance, the particle radii, the elastic constant, KT.
That also shows that the lowest order interaction between isotropic pairs invariably involves the polarization.
Yes.
Therefore, you do not get it by assuming superposition. Superposition gets you zero if you make that assumption in the theory. Mm-hmm.
This is the only diagram that is, you know, Coulombic superposition interaction.
I see.
Whereas, beginning with this guy, you know, these induced charges take care of the fact that when one source creates a deformation, the constraints on another object make sure the constraints at their rim are satisfied by creating another deformation. That is not captured in a superposition approximation. I don't know. So yeah.
So I mean, can you use this theory to try to predict, you know, patterns of, you know, for in different properties of the curvature? Is there any sense of trying to play that geometric game?
We haven't tried that yet, because you just put lots of plugins in there. You could, of course, then work out what all these interactions are and just run a simple simulation of this.
Right. Yeah.
My worry is all of these things are attractive. So what actually would happen is these things would come close together, and once they come very close together, higher and higher orders in this theory start to happen.
Yeah,
so if you look at clustering of these things, you run, of course, into the problem that something that is exact but written as a gradient expansion for large distances starts to become tedious when everything just runs into each other.
Now, is it true, though, if they're heterogeneous, that you will get the same, that you will get attraction for all the orders?
Heterogeneous?
Well, then you just said that you get attraction, right, for all of
the cosmic forces in this thing always tend to be attractive.
Yes.
The ground state forces depend on things such as orientation, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Can get attraction, can get repulsion, but it always seems to be there's some orientation where it is attractive. Well, then they're going to just find that orientation.
Well, there are some terms that do not have an attractive configuration, like two cups repelling each other through this interaction.
How would that work?
Well, this doesn't have the isotropic inclusions.
Excuse me, the ground state isotropic is repulsive.
But but this guy, by adjusting the angle between the vectors R12 and R23, it might be attractive this way, but repulsive that way.
Okay, so the Casimir forces will always then drive the proteins together.
It seems so. I don't have a rigorous proof that all these interactions are going to be attractive. For the tension Hamiltonian, I calculated all the diagrams. They're all positive, well, negative. So that counts as a rigorous proof. I know all of them are negative. In this case, I am not sure whether there are some positive diagrams or not. I don't have a rigorous proof.
So you could, in principle, do this theory for non-disc-like proteins as well, right? If you want to
do a rod,
something along
A. Yeah, that would change the polarizabilities to tensors.
Mm-hmm.
That complicates things a little. So you may not be able to find tens of diagrams, but just one or two. Because then the number of indices on the index contractions go so bad that you pretty much can't do anything.
So for the surface tension case, we have done that. We can, again, work out what all the polarizabilities are. They're just messy functions.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't the one who did that, by the way.
Oh, yeah, OK. That was Robert Hausmann. And in the film case, it turns out things turn out the matching calculation, the exact matching calculation, which you would think might be hard.
Yeah.
It turns out you can do this fairly straightforwardly by doing some conformal mapping of, let's say, I mean ellipses.
Yeah.
Mapping the ellipse to a circle and then afterwards mapping back, so you get everything. But so we can write down the effective field theory exactly. But then, as Jim said, if you want to work out your diagrams, you know at what order you need what diagrams, but these diagrams become really messy.
I see.
So we have a couple of these diagrams up to order, I believe. One of R to be, Jesus, 8, I believe, or 10, something like this. And then we ran out of steam.
Okay. But what are the prefactors on these terms? I mean, if you're going all the way up to whatever R over the A, I mean, for a lot of, wouldn't you care mostly about the far field interactions? I mean, for a lot of problems? I mean, because you're already, once things get close.
What the curve roughly looks like?
Unless they have big prefactors, right? Why would you want to know necessarily?
Well, because if you get close, you start to deviate rather substantially from the asymptotic solution.
Right.
In fact, by easily an order of magnitude, even without getting too close.
I'll show it on the screen.
Show it on the screen.
No, that's very cool.
And so my view is that if you ever want to measure this experimentally, you don't want to be in the far field.
You don't want to be.
So for the.
You
wouldn't see anything.
This is for the tension problem.
Yeah.
The dashed line is the asymptotic term.
Yeah.
You know.
Leading order.
Just do a sketch on the board for the benefit of everyone else.
That's right.
Okay.
I mean, for us, this is very interesting. This could be very useful guiding calculations.
I mean, even if you don't want to do these specific calculations, but the general principle that you have local perturbations which correspond to finite size objects, you can put this into your theory as a point particle plus extra things.
Yeah.
And you can determine what these extra things are in a framework that is much simpler than the actual theory you want to ultimately deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Because we did statistical field theory for point particles, which is much easier than statistical field theory for. And the price to pay was, well, we need to go to EFT and get all these polarizabilities, but at least we can get in a one particle situation for which the boundary value problems is very much easier without any fluctuations.
Yeah.
You have entirely disentangled the boundary complications from the statistical field theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is a major advantage of this framework.
Mm-hmm.
So when the particles are separated by about 2.5 times the radius, there's a about 10 times difference between the correct solution and the asymptotically correct solution.
Yeah. 10 times, you mean factor of 10 or 10%?
No, 10, factor of 10. This is a logarithm. The scales are logarithmic.
Log, and it's effort.
It's only two-body interactions.
That's, yeah, that's pair.
So, talking about RD4, it diverges at contact.
Yeah.
It's improved if you include further terms into the.
Yeah.
Is this a solid line?
No, the solid line is.
The solid sign is everything already.
Ah, okay. Lowest order is the line on a log scale, this line with one of our four.
Ah, okay.
Okay, I see.
And that's for the film case, not?
That's for the film case.
Oh, that's film, okay. I see. Actually, our collaborator, Mr. Rothstein, was capable of working out that solid line exactly. That frustrated us a little bit.
Exactly, we mean when he's giving it a functional form.
He can do the partition function exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. He found a closed form solution using some conformal field theory / bosonic string theory tricks that involve the Dedekind function at the end.
Okay.
Paste the
talk to these guys. Yeah. Well, he said it's still cool what we're doing here because he couldn't pull off the same trick for the membrane case because that's not conformally invariant.
I see.
So that's that.
So what are you planning on using this for? I mean, it's a very beautiful technique, but I'm wondering if you have a biophysical motivation to use this.
As far as I can imagine, no.
Not really a critique, I'm just curious, yeah.
No, I know. no, I haven't been able to think of anything of that sort. Interaction-free energy, basically.
Any other questions?
Well, I still have this question of could you measure this in some kind of Monte Carlo. You actually mentioned that you would be able to measure directly this force in your model.
Well, we have a method that in flavor is similar, although we're not doing an effective field theory, where we use the sort of free Hamiltonian and then we add a correction to it. And we do that for numerical purposes, but again, we want to exploit the locality of the change in the material properties. So we could use FFTs and all that stuff to do mutual Montague simulations. So in principle, if you told us, hey, there's an interesting configuration between, you know, proteins that have a certain shape and making a certain pattern, we could, you know, go through. I mean, if you can compute everything, there's no point to it. But
no,
you can do a Monte Carlo simulation.
I can't because I can only do linearized Monte gates.
Okay, yeah. So if we treated it with the full differential geometry of the sheet, you know, maybe putting the metric factors and things like that, then one could do a comparison to see how well this. Theory
that. What would you measure in that simulation? How would you measure the force?
How would I measure
the force between two
of them?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a fairly standard thing to do, right, in these kind of Monte Carlo simulations. So, what do you mean, how would I measure the force?
What would be the quantity to calculate? How would you calculate the force?
How would I calculate? Okay, so, I mean, I think I would look at a radial distribution function and take a logarithm of that.
So, just let the movement just track how they.
How they move, but then you have to bias the simulations, right? Because they'll tend to be, you know, widely separated as opposed to close together, right? So I'm going to do this sort of important sampling.
One thing you can do is you can bias the simulation with the inverse of the negative sign of the linear theory.
Yeah.
So in linear case, these things should be completely freely diffusing, but if anything that's remaining are the non-linear forces.
Thank you.
I'm not a theory guy, and I don't understand also what he said. But I understand the motivation behind it. And my question is that there are proteins which actually are in bacterial cells which form a highly ordered structure which is autonomous, like, you know, formed spontaneously.
Yeah.
And I mean, of course, you can do a simulation of that, and it's going to be a big system. Can you use your theory to actually look at how they assemble into such highly ordered structures, like a two-dimensional prism?
There's a transmembrane.
Yeah.
What brings them together?
Hmm?
What brings them together?
It's probably interactions.
But that's what I. So if there's any electric charges involved, for example, that would be used.
They don't have electric charges on the outside because it's a membrane inserted protein.
What would I know?
So, I mean, if they have charges there, then they're always towards inside.
But when you say protein-protein interaction, that sounds like direct interactions. The fun in this bit is that there's no direct interaction between these interactions come because of anything they do to the membrane.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could, for instance, think of proteins being embedded in the membrane for hydrophobic mismatch reasons, locally stretching or compressing the membrane. These stretching and compression fields would go away, and then you would again have an overlap of these things. And that wouldn't be, so you could write something like this, but it wouldn't be, H would then probably not be the position of the membrane, but for instance, the local stretching, you would get a field, and then you would probably get either gradient H squared or plus an H squared, stuff like this, okay. And you would repeat that thing in these things.
You know, if you happen to suspect for reasonably that the interactions are membrane mediated and there's no aggregation but regular structure, which would mean there is some repulsion as well, I would maybe try to look for repulsive terms there, as long as where they come together is very gently curved. If it's like a bud,
yeah.
With protein sitting like this, that would be just crap, actually.
The protein I was thinking about is rhodopsin, and bacteriorhodopsin, to be very specific. And this protein actually forms a two-dimensional crystal with it's so perfect that you can actually crystallize it in the membrane in two-dimensional. From what I know about the protein, there are no charge interactions on the outside of the protein. Mm-hmm. And the protein actually interacts entirely through hydrophobic interaction with the lipid. And I would assume that the direct interaction between the proteins is to a minimal because it's in a hydrophobic lipid.
Yeah, if the distance between the proteins in that structure is sort of larger than the typical healing length of the thickness, maybe one can say, okay, these are probably longer ranged interactions like this rather than those. As far as I know, the thickness stuff has a length scale, right?
My suspicion, though, is that in that case, proteins are so close to each other that the distance between their surfaces is incomparable to lipid size, in which case continuum theories of that kind become hard to use.
Yeah.
That's correct, because there are only 13 lipids
per so. It's one ring of lipids.
I mean, what about cases where the proteins have some kind of additional degrees of freedom? So the Hamiltonian not only includes H, but something that...
You mean lipids?
No, I mean the proteins. I mean, I'm just thinking about directions you could push this effective field theory. You know, let's say that I replace the actual protein with, you know, a hole, you know, like a little pore in the monolith. Could you model pore-pore interactions?
I think so.
You know, where maybe the radius can get larger or smaller based on some kind of line tension.
Yeah.
So it's not really proteins any longer, but the same kind of might be applicable.
How the surface knows about the inclusions, the perturbations, if you will, is through the boundary conditions applied. So if I know what the boundary conditions should be on the surface at the edge of a pore, well, then the EFT is going to be the same form. It will just, only the boundary value problem will be a bit different because the boundary conditions are different. So the polarizabilities or charges will have maybe different values. But the theory is of the same form, the diagrams are the same.
Yeah, then you would have the additional challenge, I guess, also over averaging. You'd have an additional degree of freedom you'd have to do your averages on. So, right, because I mean, if you freeze, of course, the pore at a particular radius, then I agree, you can do the whole first part. Then when you're computing the cumulatives, I guess that's where it would get interesting. Because now you'd be averaging over the... you'd be finding effective terms.
What's the additional degree of freedom you're talking about?
The radius of
that can fluctuate.
Imagine that can change.
Then such a matching procedure may not be suitable.
Okay.
I'd have to think about that.
I mean, see.
Because that's a very stationary matching procedure.
Right, that's
That might be, I suspect such a fluctuating object might require higher than quadratic terms in the free energy, because say you have a quartic term along these guys, four legs, that would mean in a diagram vertices start to overwhelm the number of links, and that would account for interactions that go like kt squared over kappa instead of just kt, for example. So those interactions remind me of things that represent short distance physics that already fluctuate, because there's temperature corrections along on top of the usual Casimir interactions that are proportional to kt. So I would suspect maybe in that case the quadratic word line terms are not enough.
I'm not sure. Imagine you have, let's say, a particle the size of which you can change.
Yeah.
And you just look at the dipole or quadrupole or whatever polarizability, and you know what that is. For any fixed size of R, you know what that polarizability is and how that you think would behave. Except that your final answer now would be written as blah, 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 R1 squared, R2 squared, da, da, da. But R1 is still a random variable you haven't averaged over.
That's right.
So it would seem you would have to do some extra averaging over this thing. And it's not obvious, of course, that you can do this after this, and you take this and then average over.
Okay, yeah.
But there's probably some, the terms are probably okay, but there's this extra partition function over the R degree of freedom that's in there.
Yep.
You would have to trace through how that goes to the calculation.
Yeah, oh, okay. That makes sense.
But in some sense, anything this theory, as it's written is only sort of symmetry limited. I mean, every term that's permitted by symmetry is there. And then what these numbers are, which you don't know yet, is determined by a matching. So whether these are circles or squares or wiggles or holes, or as long as what they are can be determined by a full theory response, you get the same equations. You just have to replace your polarizabilities by whatever that particular situation amounts to. That's occasionally quite convenient. For instance, for the question when you ask, all right, what if I now take particles that are not circular, but they are like ellipses?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to the interactions?
Mm-hmm.
And do you get lower order terms, for instance? And I say, well, as long as the thing can still warm up and tilt down, the mono and dipole polarizabilities will be zero, so and it still can only start with a quadrupole. And then by power counting, we know that the lowest order term has to be of order blah, blah, blah. And that's quite cute. You haven't done any calculation up to this point. Already kind of understood why symmetry baking that situation isn't going to give you lower order terms.
Any other
questions?
Okay, thank you. Thank you.